this is where it's messy. Elon Musk spent the equivalent of you or I spending about $100. He spent $250 million to make Donald Trump president. And I've got to tell you, the founding fathers never intended for somebody like that to have that much power. And that is what's disgusting in all of this. If I'm going to take votes to send people to war, and I'm going to ask somebody to give their life for a country, literally the ultimate sacrifice, right? If I'm gonna be in a position to do that, how in the world could I put my own interest in having this job above the interest of the country if I'm gonna be asking people to die for it? That's what pisses me off. If you're gonna ask a 19-year-old to end his story, to defend a country, and you are unwilling to give up a $174,000 a year job, screw you. You're getting your ass kicked, you know, on
get my
the
ass
other
kicked
40.
Anywhere, okay?
Here, the other.
Also, just heads up, we're live, so don't say anything crazier, okay?
Okay.
Thanks. I appreciate the nice words. Okay. I just wanted to pick your brain real quick because these videos come up all the time about the evil lobbyists, okay? I'm not here to defend the lobbyists or whatever. But my understanding is that, like, obviously you guys have to deal with a ton of stuff in Congress that comes across your desk in terms of, like, how do you legislate, how do you not? I know that you have staffers to help you figure out some stuff. Can you explain what is it? Can you just explain, like, what does a lobbyist do? How do they interface with you? What does that whole process look like? And then what's your, like,
yeah.
opinion on that? Yeah.
So, like, I think you set it up right, which is to say, so if you think about it, a typical day, if it's like a full day in Congress, you probably have two different sessions of voting. You know, you may go around noon and then in the evening. And of that, you may deal with one issue to three issues a day, right? And some of them are very nuanced. So, obviously, your staff has a very important job to figure out what's going on. And a lot of the times they can reach out to lobbyists, or lobbyists will reach out with the information. And so I'm going to tell you, lobbyists in some cases deserve the rap that they get. In some cases, it's undeserved. But the interaction, so from a fundraising perspective, and this is the part I hate about it, a lobbyist can bring either their own personal money. So many of them will write like a personal check if they're supporting you. Or they have a pack associated with whatever their interest is. So let's say it's the carpenters, right? Uh-huh. You know, they in a pack, now this is different from a super pack. A uh-huh. standard pack has all the limits for what the members of that pack can donate, and then that pack can give you like $5,000.
Yeah. And then also, wait, can I back up one sec? I don't know if you're aware of this or not, okay, but the average American, me included, our level of civics knowledge is basically nothing, okay? Mm-hmm. So just when you said before, they write you a personal check. When you said that, I assume what you mean is they will write a check with the maximum allowable amount being up to $5,000 to either your campaign or like a PAC-aligned campaign, right? Not like they're giving you, Adam, like
that's a good point.
Okay. Yeah, okay, just, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's a great point. It would be a much more lucrative job if they could do that. But so there's like the PAC money. So a PAC, again, if you want me to explain this, it's basically, let's say you and I are interested in gaming, right? And we have issues that we're concerned with in Washington. Washington wants to ban certain games. Mm-hmm. We could start a PAC, a political action committee. You and I and anybody else that's a member can donate to that PAC. And then that PAC can give up to $5,000 to each member of Congress, okay? So you can come with that. Or in some cases, lobbyists who are very rich, they can write you a check out of their own money and give it to your campaign. So from a financial perspective, that's that. The interaction on the legislative side, and we can drill as deep as you want on any of these, but on the legislative side, let's say the issue of gaming is coming up for a vote on Monday. And my staffer or I don't really know what are the nuances behind it. We can talk to that lobbyist who will come in and be like, okay, here's what our industry is concerned with. They want to do, and I really don't know the industry that well to even give you examples, but they want to do X, Y, and Z. We think Y and Z is bad, and here's why. And then in some cases, you can call the other side, the people that are against gaming. They can come in and talk to you. But they're basically the contact point for people that are interested in a specific issue, because when you have 10 staffers, five are usually the ones that focus on the legislation. I mean, we'd end up voting really stupidly because we'd have no idea what these issues are. Sure. So they do bring a benefit in that way, but there's also a dark side to it.
Can I ask, for staffers in Congress, is that stuff that you're funding out of your own campaign, or is there like a congressional budget that allots for some predetermined amount of staffers?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think the number right now, we're limited to 17 or 18 staffers that we can hire. Uh-huh. So I'm going to speak as if I'm still there. I get a budget every year. It's probably about $1.2 million. Out of that budget is, you know, my office in my district, my travel. So if I'm traveling to and from DC, obviously I'm not paying for it personally. Uh-huh. The salaries, but not the benefits, the salaries of my staff members. So my chief of staff would be my highest paid staffer, and they used to be limited to what a member of Congress makes. They raised that. So a chief of staff may make $200,000 a year, and you go all the way down to like a legislative correspondent or a staff assistant. A legislative correspondent, their job is, if you ever wrote to your congressman and you get a letter back, that's probably the legislative correspondent that wrote that. That's kind of a starting point for then becoming a legislative aide. They're the ones that actually drill deep. So like for me, I had at any given time probably three legislative aides, and they divide all these issues among the three of them. So one may deal with guns, one may deal with, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so that's how it works. And their job is then to drill in. But yes, that all comes out of, and an interesting point, all comes out of the budget I get. An interesting point about that, for a few years, I wouldn't spend all of it. Uh-huh. So that goes back to the Treasury in theory. If you ever spend over your budget, the member of Congress is on the hook personally to cover that. It's never really actually been done, but technically, if I would spend too much, I would be on the hook.
Okay. And when you say Treasury here, you mean like the U.S. Treasury. This is like funded by the government, not the DNC or the
Correct.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yep. And in fact, you have, now again, I think in the last couple of years, particularly with what the Republicans are doing, they've started to really blend this together too much. But we always would have a significant firewall. So if you came in to talk to me in my office, let's say, my official office in D.C., uh-huh. and you're like, hey, here's our gaming issue that we're concerned about. Oh, by the way, I also want to give you $5,000. That would be illegal. You cannot blend the political with the official side. Is that always held up to? Of course not, right? We got a lot of sleaze bags over there. But technically, all of that is supposed to be firewalled and separate.
Gotcha. Is it normal that all the staffers and legislative aides and everything, do these people all live in D.C. full-time?
Yeah. Yep. So I have like kind of two tranches of staff. So there's the D.C. staff. Uh-huh. And then back home, I have like district staff. Their job is basically, they'll set up my meetings when I'm home. They'll kind of travel around and go to all the meetings I can't go to. I represented 700,000 people, so it's pretty big. It was like 14 counties. And so, yeah, so they're kind of the out talking to people folks. But in D.C., they're focused on the legislation. And then, of course, your chief of staff, which is like the thing you want to be if you're like a D.C. staffer.
Yeah.
They kind of oversee everything.
Gotcha. Okay. Would you say that when you guys are approached by lobbyists, do you think that lobbyists are generally trying to approach congressmen that they think already or would roughly like ideologically align, and then they're trying to provide like the epistemic or know-how tools for doing legislation? Or do you think lobbyists are ever approaching you guys and they're like, I know that you're completely against this issue, but I'm going to explain why you should be on the total opposite side?
So that's a really good question. It's, you know, I think typically, so like I was a very pro-union Republican, okay? Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of support of the unions. So the unions knew that. So they would approach me and we'd talk and all that kind of stuff. We'd have events, whatever. The anti-union Republicans, you wouldn't really see a union lobbyist go approach them because they know it's a waste of time. Now, in many cases, somebody may be like, hey, I'm open to chatting with you about these issues, in which case, yes. But the big thing to keep in mind, and this is where stuff gets kind of, I think, muddled in the, which is why I'm glad you're doing this, is it gets muddled out there, is there is a limit to what a lobbyist can give you financially. So this idea that they can come with truckloads of money and convince you to vote for this issue, there's no lobbyist that can legally bring more than like $5,000. And when you're dealing with, you know, I got to raise $2 million or $4 million this campaign cycle, you have to have absolutely no moral fortitude to change your view and your position and how you would vote if it was just for $5,000. Now, one thing to keep in mind is there are many issues out there that people don't really have many opinions about. I could come up with something now and you'd be like, I don't really know either way, right? Mm-hmm. And in that case, a lobbyist could see that as an opportunity to go and kind of describe their side and swing somebody over. The other sad thing, though, is like, it really, many of these issues are just straight up down the line partisan. Somebody in the party somewhere makes a decision, we're on this side, and everybody kind of sticks to that.
Yeah. The, I've noticed that's a problem. That's a whole separate set of things.
That's a 5-hour conversation too.
I'm kind of curious on, I'm trying to think. My overall take on like lobbying related stuff is one of the things that frustrates me so much about U.S. politics is like everybody thinks that everything is corrupt and rigged and terrible. And because of that view, when things are actually corrupt and rigged and terrible, people don't realize like how bad a thing can be. And for the lobbying stuff, there are so many numbers or figures that get thrown around where like people will have a stat where it's like, you know, 96% of the people that this lobbyist supported voted this way or whatever.
Right.
And I've talked to now several people that have been in Congress, and what you just said is the answer they usually give. And when you think about it that way, it's like, well, if you're a pro-union guy and then a union lobbyist comes up to you, well, you're probably already voting that way anyway. But I think a lot of people, when they hear those stats, like 96% of congressmen voted with, you know, AIPAC or this lobbyist or whatever, it's like, well, AIPAC's not voting to people that are throwing money at people that hate, you know, Israel or Israeli interests or whatever. Not to bring up AIPAC, the most politically charged issue, but like generally when a lobbyist is supporting somebody, usually they're already kind of like on that side anyway. And then the big issues that I see where lobbyists can make a lot of headway are just things that like nobody knows anything about. Like if there's like a lobbyist corporation for why we should use copper gold alloy, you know, electrical wires, like maybe they could have a great influence in Congress because the average citizen just doesn't have much of an opinion on it.
That's exactly right. And that's the thing is like there are so when I say like unions, for example, it's not like we have votes that are like unions yes or unions no. There are so many things in there from like, you know, okay, we're going to talk about minimum wage here. We're going to talk about immigration. Unions typically are more restrictive on immigration. We're going to talk about right to work. We're going to, you know, there's all these little nuances that they have to deal with those issues. If you think about it, we have obviously the biggest economy in the world. If you think about anything for now, if you think about anything, there's always all these different things. So there's no way that one person can research all these issues and know.
And then one of the second things on that, because you brought up the super PAC idea, is I don't think people understand all the time when it comes to like PAC or like campaign aligned PAC, like contribution limits or individual campaign contribution limits. So the idea that a guy can show up at Congress and, you know, he can only give it's like $5,000 or $5,500 or whatever. I think it's $5,000, you know, you said to your campaign is one thing. But then there's this concept of the super PAC that as long as they're not directly working with you, but maybe you have like a YouTube channel where you upload 100 hours of footage, of, you know, maybe they can use it if they want, right? That these people can spend infinite amounts of money on issues makes that topic a lot more kind of crazy. But I don't think people realize sometimes how extreme the super PAC spending can be because people think that a lobbyist can just go to Congress and give you guys like $500,000 anyway. And when they give you money, the reason why I clarified earlier is because I think the average, I think that people don't realize sometimes, not to attack people in Congress, but how little sometimes the money is in Congress, especially compared to even like the YouTube world. Like I'm sure there's a lot of guys in Congress who saw Tim Pool getting paid $5 million in 1 year from Russia. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, no,
because a lot of people think the lobbying money goes right into the congressman's personal bank accounts. Like, oh, I just got bribed, basically. You know, they always call it legal bribery. Which drives me insane. How do you feel about
it? It used to be I don't remember when it was, maybe the 50s or something. They brought in kind of the rules in terms of you can't take money. Because technically, here's an interesting thing. I had my office in the Rayburn House office building, and we have safes in there. And the old heads would tell me that back in the day, a lobbyist could walk in with a sack of cash, throw it on your desk, and you just keep it in the safe. Obviously, that was corrupt. That was wrong. And so, yeah, what you basically have, and I'll go through I won't bore you guys, but I'll go through the very top line on this. An individual can give, if it goes up every year, but I think it's like $3,200. So if you were going to write a check to my campaign, it's like $3,200 or $3,300, whatever it is nowadays. If you're married, your spouse can get, you know, there's all that kind of stuff. And then you can give for the primary in general. Mm-hmm. So you can double that. PACs have always been limited to $5,000, where the super PAC comes in. Now, here's another thing. If I'm independently rich, I can obviously write my campaign an infinite check. I think that should change, by the way. I think if you're rich, you should be able to give your campaign exactly what you could give my campaign.
Yeah.
But the super PAC is the dark money that came in after the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United. Uh-huh. And what that said is that money is speech. And so let's say you're Elon Musk. I don't know. Let's just use him as an example. And you want to give $250 million. You want to spend it on politics. You can't give that to me, legally at least. But what you can do is say, I'm super interested in politics. I'm going to create the Elon, I don't know, it's called the America PAC or whatever he named it. And I'm going to independently spend money out there. And there's no limits on that. And the worst thing about it is they don't even have to. There's too many sub nuances to get into. But generally, they don't even have to release who their donors are. Mm-hmm. So you can get Russian money. You could get, you know, real super dark money. And as long as that's washed through somebody, there's no way to track it and check it. That's where it gets really wrong. I had a buddy when all this started that was running for the Senate in Colorado, and he was a moderate Republican. And he told me, he goes, look, I am doing my best to avoid talking about the issue of abortion, because he was kind of centrist on it.
Sure.
He said, I've spent $50 million, never talked about abortion. He goes, but somebody could come in, write a $100 million check to this super PAC, and all of a sudden make the campaign all about abortion. And you've seen this, to be fair, on both sides, where now Democratic PACs are supporting the craziest Republican in the primary, or the Republicans are coming in and supporting the Democrat they think they can beat the most. This is where it's messy. Elon Musk spent the equivalent of you or I spending about $100. He spent $250 million to make Donald Trump president. And I've got to tell you, the founding fathers never intended for somebody like that to have that much power. And that is what's disgusting in all of this.
Sure. You guys cite that figure a lot. I look more at like the $44 billion, I think, that he spent buying X. I feel like that was
yeah,
crazy.
Totally.
He definitely did donate. He did the America PAC and everything else. Yeah, I hate the I got so interested in like legal stuff, and I've read so much now. And then every new Supreme Court decision, I'm like, I don't know why I wasted my time reading anything, because apparently nothing matters, especially
yeah,
reading anything
matters.
Alito writes. Yeah, the whole like you can't buy votes from people, obviously. But then I think Elon Musk doing like the $1 million a day giveaway. I think it was in Wisconsin or whatever. I'm like, what are we doing here? It's it's crazy.
Yeah. And this is the thing. This is where I think like, even if you're somebody on the right or somebody on the left, you don't know what you are, right? I'm mm-hmm. kind of politically homeless myself. I think this is the one thing that should unite all of us, which is like, dude, listen, obviously, you know, if you're rich, you're going to have more influence in society. That's not something you can get away from. But the idea that we have this oligarchy that can come in and do things like buy X, buy CNN, you know, buy Paramount, CBS, and basically control the narrative. It's why people like you and independent media have become so important, is to get around what is really turning into kind of an information oligarchy out there.
A little bit, yeah. So I'm a hater. I hate independent media more than, and I understand I'm a mutated creature of it, because the problem is everybody in independent media gets away with this, like, you guys are all bought by corporations and you guys all do it for the profit center. But nobody ever talks about, like, well, how much money do you get to say that exact thing? Because all the people in my side of the internet get paid insane amounts of money for the, oftentimes more than, well, not oftentimes, but if you're at the top, like more than a lot of the hosts on a lot of these mainstream media networks. So I do think it's worth talking about that sometimes. The super PAC issue, that's another issue where, almost related to the lobbying thing, it's really granular, because on one end, you know, like, should you be able to spend an infinite amount of money on an election cycle? I mean, like, probably not. But then on another end, like, I'm sympathetic to the idea that if there is a candidate who is super pro or anti-climate change, and I have really strong feelings about it, and I want to spend a lot of money, you know, creating a documentary, running ads for it, what the Citizens United case was kind of about, should I really be restricted from doing that? Like, it's a tough issue.
It's a tough question. Yeah. It really is, because the libertarian side of like the idea of freedom basically says, do what you want with your money, mm-hmm. right? I understand that. And then there's the side of, but if you're extremely wealthy, should you have a significant amount of input in the future? Or are we really a country that believes in kind of one man, one vote?
Yeah.
And it's tough. And I think it's a real discussion, but I think what we're seeing is, if you look at what has happened of late, particularly the last 10 years, you can kind of see the corruption that that comes in. And so at some point it's like, yeah, this may violate my kind of personal libertarian freedom sense, but at the same time, I'm seeing what the outcome is. So we maybe have to get a little, I don't know, a little perverted in how we think this goes at this point.
Yeah. There, I don't know if you ever heard, there's something called a Nirvana fallacy, or boiled down to a statement. It's like, don't let perfect become the enemy of the good or something. Yeah, and sometimes when you start to suggest, like, well, maybe we could clamp down on this, people will come out very quickly and it'll be like, well, who decides this? And what if the government goes too far? And it's like, well, you know, they might, and that would be bad. But right now, whatever we have right now is not working. This is whatever we have right now is not working. So something has to change. And whatever the change might be, and might not be perfect, but like the direction we're at right now is not good.
Yeah. And then the other thing is, like, what can we actually find that we can get 51% of the people to agree with? Or in the case of money, it's a constitutional amendment, which is another thing that's going to take, it's a 10-year fight here. But, you know, what is the thing that we can actually pass? I dealt with this a lot of times in Congress, where if we were trying to deal with an issue, people in my own party, the right particularly, would tank it because we weren't cutting enough spending or we weren't doing this enough. Mm-hmm. And you, that's it. You let perfect become the enemy of good and nothing gets done. And we end up basically handing power to an orange buffoon.
There's kind of this niche movement online. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's talking about uncapping the House. Have you ever heard of this before? Do you have any feelings on this? Do you think it should be uncapped?
Is this the one where you, where you go from 435 up, right?
Yeah, like 900 or 1,000,
Yeah, so it's, I have a mixed feeling about this, and let me give you the good and bad and how I see it. The good, obviously, you know, I represented 700,000 people. Clearly, I couldn't get to know everybody in my district, big district. And so a smaller district with less people is beneficial for being able to kind of touch base. The problem is 435 people in the House is a lot. And one of the things that the House kind of moves on and drives on is personal relationships. And so if you now have 1,000 people or 1,500 people from the district to their member of Congress, yeah, you have a good touch there, right? You have more of a chance to go meet that person. But now you have 1,500 people in one building that you're voting and trying to build relationships on. I mean, I tell you the funniest thing, dude, is I would meet people. Even I was in Congress 12 years. Occasionally, I would see somebody and be like, "Who is that? I've never seen them before." And they're like, "Oh, they've been here 10 years, right?" So that's the concern I have, is like, you're going to make this thing so massive that the personal relationship is gone, and that drives even more this idea of like, the only way to distinguish myself is to be batshit crazy and say stupid lunatic things. Mm-hmm. And so I worry about it a little bit. So what I would personally do is I would be against uncapping the House, but I also am not, it's not one of these things I would die on a hill for, because I can see the merits in all of it.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. And then this is I don't think I asked you this last time. Kind of semi-personal question. You did, I think my chat, we all finally watched, because you, it was a wider release for the documentary-ish thing you did, The Last Republican. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a two-parter question. So I think the director guy, I'm assuming is the guy that was interviewing you, was the director, or was the, so he was a lib cuck, all right? He was a left-leaning guy. So how did you decide to do that with him? And then kind of like a second part of that is, and I have this problem sometimes, especially 10 years ago as a Democrat, how do you be a conservative Republican person who is heavily critical, I would imagine, of the MAGA movement and everything, without being like a useful idiot or a tool for people on the left who just want to cast you as like, see, this guy is why all Republicans are losers and idiots or whatever. Yeah. How do you do that?
Mm-hmm.
Or how do
you, it's think tough. Of it? It's tough. And, you know, look, first off, his name is Steve Pink. He actually did Hot Tub Time Machine, one of my favorite movies. When I was in the war, we'd watch that probably every week. And he did all of that and Gross Point Blank and some other stuff. They actually came to me. So the main financer guy is a guy named Kevin Morris, who has an interest in South Park. And I had like 100 people that wanted to do documentaries. And it was all like, are you going to run again? Can you get reelected? And that was boring to me, and I knew I wasn't going to run again. Well, they came, and they're like, we're interested in the human side of things. And that's the story that I think needed told, which is like, you know how it is being a known personality. People see you as a two-dimensional character, but you do have three dimensions. And I think to the extent you can show people that, particularly in politics, it's important. So we took a risk, but it turned out really well. So anybody, you can Google or go on YouTube, and it's The Last Republican. It's out free now. But then the question about how do you not become a useful idiot? You can be a useful idiot to some people, right? Some people can take what you say They use that. The reality is you just got to be true to what you believe. And that goes both ways. So when I got out of Congress, one of the things I was able to do is kind of unbind myself to what is the typical Republican side of this argument and be able to look at it with fresh eyes. And one thing I discovered is from the day I was elected to the day I got out, I matured, I grew up, I saw the world differently. I basically was elected a year after I had been in combat. This is now 13 years later, and so my feelings on war change a little bit. And being able, willing, and ready to say, I was wrong on that issue, or I've evolved on that issue. And I think when you're willing to show that kind of humility, and humility doesn't play well on the internet, but when you're able to say, like, look, I've changed my mind, and it comes from a real position in your heart, not from, I need to please the left or I need to please the right so I can get more subscribers. If it comes from a real place in your heart, I gotta tell you, the one thing that is amazing, that people have an amazing skill for, is to sniff out authenticity. Except for Donald Trump. People think he's authentic and he's not. But for the most part, people can sniff out authenticity. So look, there are going to be people that, you know, that call me a useful idiot. I just know who I am. I know what's true to me. And I think that's the best you can do. But the one thing I'll say, and this is something that I struggle against all the time, is do your best not to just, what is it, to play to the audience. What's it called? Like audience capture, where you're like, oh, I got a bunch of left now, or I got a bunch of right now, I got to play to them. It's not worth it. It's not worth your soul. Some things you can, you know, go around on the margins, but that's it. Just be authentic, I think, is the big key. And I think people can feel that. And look, man, I think people are desperate for somebody that breaks the mold of like your typical politician. It's why Trump did well, because he did break that mold. Like, I think, you know, if somebody came along that was like socially moderate to conservative and fiscally a little more liberal, I think that person would play well. Just there's no place for that person in either of the political parties. So I think that's it. I think, frankly, the younger generation is breaking the mold of what politics looks like. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It's there's no hard line on it. Obviously, it's a thing you have to constantly think about.
Yeah, you really do.
So something that comes up a ton, especially in this administration, is this idea of sometimes stuff is really messed up, and if you're on the outside, you want to criticize it. If you're on the inside, you might have issues, but you have to make this decision of like, do I want to remain inside because I think I'm like a better fighter here, or do I want to try to cash out like my political power now and make a big change kind of on my way out? I imagine, I think you knew when joining the J6 Select Committee that you were probably going to be on your way out after that, right? So so you made that decision of like, I'm going out because I think this is important enough to fight on. What's like the deciding factor between, I'm sure at least one person in your life was like, don't you want to stay in the Republican Party so that you can be at least one of the good voices on the Republican side in the Congress? Like, is that an important position for you? How do you make the decision there between like, no, this is the hill that I think I'm going to die on, even if it means I have to exit my political position?
I had more than one person. I had like 1,000 people that are like, what are you doing? You know, don't you want to stay? Here's the way I look at it is like, is it an oath-breaking decision? Like, an oath is something that I've taken very seriously, like, both when I got elected to Congress, obviously as a military officer. And, you know, if it's something like, hey, I'm going to vote against this tax cut or for this tax cut or whatever, because it keeps me kind of in good graces so I can be effective, that's understandable, right? Politics is a little bit of give and take. But in the case of January 6th, to me, like, my kid is 4 years old. And I could not imagine sitting down with him, talking to him about truth, talking to him about what it means to do the right thing, like trying to give him courage. And then he looks in the history book and sees my last name and his last name and is like, yeah, but you were a fucking coward, right? You didn't do it. And to me, it was that moment when it's like, could I look at myself in the mirror and honestly say that I would be the person that my son could look up to? Can I honestly say that I am keeping my oath? Look, man, here's the crazy thing. And this is the thing that blows me away about every member of Congress. You represent 700,000 people. Soldier Field, you know, the Bears has like whatever it is, 50,000 capacity, let's say. That means out of 14 Soldier Fields, that, you know, put 14 Soldier Fields next to each other, you pick one person. And you're that person. That is a massive responsibility. And it's not your job. It's the people's job. And if you can look in the mirror and say, I'm doing my best for these 700,000 people, even if they don't agree with me, then cool. On the January 6th stuff, I couldn't do that, except that I didn't want to be on the committee. I did not want to be on the January 6th committee. I voted, obviously, for it, voted the right way. When Pelosi called me and asked me to do it, I'm like, son of a bitch. Like,
why did she call you? Did you guys have like a personal relationship, or did she just...
They started sniffing around because they needed another Republican. Yeah. And, you know, obviously Liz Cheney and I were the two most outspoken. And yeah, she just called and kind of personally. Here's the funny story about it, though. She had her kind of minions, including Jamie Raskin, talk to me to see if I'd say yes. And I told them all, I'm like, look, I'll do it because I can't say no. I don't want it. And then I wake up Sunday morning, like at 9 a.m. or 8 a.m., and she had already been on a Sunday show basically announcing that I was on the committee, and then she called me. So that kind of pissed me off a little bit, but I knew I was going to do it, and my life changed at that moment. But that's the big thing. Can you look in the mirror? Here's one more quick thing for you. So Andreas O'Keefe is a buddy of mine that was killed in Iraq in 2018. And I look, if I'm going to take a vote, and I thought I got elected in 2010 and I made this conscious decision, which is like, if I'm going to take votes to send people to war, to outfit them for war, to train them for war, and I'm going to ask somebody to give their life for a country, literally the ultimate sacrifice, right? And now that I have a kid, I can understand what that is even better than when I was in the war. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to be in a position to do that, how in the world could I put my own interest in having this job above the interest of the country if I'm going to be asking people to die for it? And I got to tell you, the number of people that I worked with, I served with, that I see saluting caskets that come, you know, land at Dover, giving a tearful speech about how amazing it is we have people willing to die for this country. And they walk in and they're cowards on things like January 6th, and they're cowards about whatever. Those people don't deserve it. And unfortunately, 95% of Congress is that. That's what pisses me off. If you're going to ask a 19-year-old to end his story, to defend a country, to give the ultimate, and you are unwilling to give up a $174,000 a year job, screw you. Sure. And that was my position. And that stuck with me the whole time. And I think it all culminated, whether you believe in God or not, I do. It all culminated in that moment when it's like, okay, now you have to make a decision. Are you going to say the thing that you've been saying for 10 years, are you going to live up to it?
Okay. And then we're close to the end of our time here. One more question. I'm just curious. And then you can take off as soon as you need to as well. Just, I have a hard time sometimes with theory of mind for these people, okay? So I grew up, I don't know if I mentioned this last time, my mom is from Cuba, so I grew up in a very Republican household. Like, I follow these people for a long time, okay? You know, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, I've seen these guys. And I'm not telling you to judge just those two guys or make a specific call out, but I see some of these conservatives, and I know that growing up and everything leading up to this point for this administration, for the first one, this is not consistent at all with their internal belief system. Do you think that for people like that in Congress, in the Senate or in the House, are these people, are they tricking themselves into thinking that like this is what they have to do, or that it's not a big deal, or do they know that they're violating their principles, or have they convinced themselves that maybe their principles have changed, or what is your theory of mind, I guess, for the person like that?
It's kind of all of it, but let me give you my top line on this. Is like, and I'm not comparing them to Nazis, okay? But how is it that you take somebody in 1935 that probably really had no issue with the Jews, and then by 1945, they're guarding a tower in Auschwitz? How does that happen? Uh-huh. The answer isn't Hitler comes along and says, I need you to guard a tower at Auschwitz where we're exterminating the Jews. It happens very slowly, one decision at a time, right? A little bit, yeah, I do think the Jews own too many stores. Yeah, I do think kicking them out of this part of Warsaw is probably smart. And you make these little decisions, you compromise your soul, and then eventually that next decision is a small compromise. Or you have sunken cost fallacy where you've invested so much in this anyway that you need to see it through to the end. Let's take Marco Rubio. Let's take Ted Cruz because I can't stand him especially. Okay. Let's say if Ted Cruz all of a sudden says, you know what? Donald Trump is a piece of shit. I was wrong. Everything I said about him was wrong. What is he admitting? He's admitting his part in making Donald Trump who he is. And he's admitting that the last 10 years of his life have been you know, a disaster as well, that he's played a part in that. And listen, humans are very, very capable to convince ourselves of anything. Everybody thinks they're the good guy, by the way. Al-Qaeda thinks they're the good guy. Mm-hmm. And so what happens, those little decisions at a time, till eventually you look and you're like, wow, okay, we're here, but I got to see this thing through. Another thing, though, is it isn't proximity to power is very intoxicating. Let me tell you my personal stories with Trump. So I didn't support him in 2016. I was one of the Republicans that I didn't support him. I was in Congress, so he hated me. About 2 months into the first term, I get invited to the White House. I go. We're talking about like Syria or Afghanistan or something. And I just assume, okay, he's going to see me. He knows who I am, and he's going to chew my ass out, okay? So I walk in. I'm ready for it. He's the president now. And he just looks at me, and he goes, "You're great on television." And I was like, "Oh, well, thank you, Mr. President. No, I'm serious. You're great on television." There was like 10 of us. The whole time in that meeting, he just kept going, saying to everybody, "He's great on television." And I realized what he does. Like, he's letting me know I'm watching. He's letting me know I have a chance. Like, I could still be Donald Trump's buddy. And boy, I got to tell you, that is intoxicating. It is drawing. I had to consciously resist, you know, leaving and being like, actually, Donald Trump is God. He's the greatest thing ever, because I would have gotten that affirmation from him. And I've seen so many people. Let's take
Bill Maher or Bill Maher.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
I knew that would happen. I knew it. Or I see Mike Waltz. Mike Waltz signed the letter in 2016 of all these national security guys. Mike Waltz is now the UN ambassador, where he's like, Donald Trump is unfit. I literally watched as he took a flight from D.C. to Florida with Donald Trump. He went on skeptical, came out with all his MAGA shit on. That happens all the time. Proximity to power is intoxicating.
There's this the Andrew Tate guy. I don't know how much you follow him, but there are so many friends I know that have strong opinions about him. And then they'd meet him, and then they'd come back. Actually, this guy's actually a really nice person. And it's like, no shit. Yes. This is what that's what he does. How do you not?
Yes.
Obviously, yeah, that drives me insane.
Look, anybody that has power, they got there because they're good at working people.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I want to be respectful of your time, so thanks.
Nah, man, I enjoyed this. Thanks for having me.
I'll shoot you a message if I have any more questions about anything, and good luck with everything.
Yeah,
and
have me back. I enjoy it.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, everybody.
Have a good one, man.
All right, see ya.
Bye. Okay.
That guy's the goat.
What do you mean? Like, he looks like a goat?
No, he, like, is. It's really cool that he stood by his own morals and didn't go and fucking just suck Trump's dick.
True.
I didn't know he was on the
Select Committee.
Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah. Him and I think Matt Gaetz, was he the speaker? Or was he the minority party speaker leader? I don't know if those are the same or different. But I think Pelosi wanted to put together the J6 Select Committee, and she wanted to have, I think it was like 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans, or maybe it was 5 and 5 or something. And it was McCarthy. And when she went to McCarthy, she was like, give me 4 or 5 Republicans that can join this. And then McCarthy gave her a list, and there were a few people on the list who were like implicated in J6 stuff. I think Jim Jordan and I think Matt Gaetz maybe were the 2 or 3. And so Pelosi was like, well, these 3 can't be it. So like, these 2 are fine, but can you pick 3 others? And then McCarthy was like, no, we're not sending anybody. Fuck you. And then Pelosi had to try to tap Republicans, and the 2 that she was able to get on were Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. So obviously those 2 were cast out of the party completely afterwards for that. But then the Republicans got their dream of saying, oh, well, that was just a Democrat led and with 2 rhinos, because McCarthy knew, Kevin knew, that if he didn't participate, he could just say like, oh, well, look, well, there were no real Republicans on that, so it's not legitimate. Yeah. The 3 that Pelosi didn't accept were Andy Biggs, Jim Jordan, and Scott Perry, I think, because I think the 3 of them were directly kind of implicated in J6 stuff, and it would have been weird to have them on the committee investigating it, yeah.
I'll have to watch The Last Republican. I haven't seen it.
Wait, really? You've watched it twice.
I mean, how often am I here? Pepe.